Welcome to Lexington, Missouri, and to Bullets, Buglers, and Bales of Hemp, a walking and driving tour of the Battle of Lexington's State Historic Site and the Wentworth Military Academy. For a safe, enjoyable experience, please listen carefully to the driving directions and follow all safe road practices. Keep in mind that all roads are active thoroughfares. Feel free to turn on your emergency blinkers so other drivers are alerted if you are going slowly. Watch closely for approaching traffic, cross traffic, and pedestrians, particularly children playing or crossing streets. The starting point for this tour is the Lafayette County Courthouse on Main Street. Listen now for driving directions to the first stop, the Battle of Lexington State Historic Site, and enjoy Bullets, Buglers, and Bales of Hemp.
The starting point for this tour is the Lafayette County Courthouse on Main Street between 10th and 11th Streets. Park in front of the courthouse, facing toward the 11th Street stoplight. Pause these directions as needed as you travel to the battle site. This is a driving tour of approximately 1.3 miles. Start by going east on Main to the stoplight at 13th Street, where you will turn left. At the stoplight, 13th Street becomes John Shea Drive. Turn left here and follow the tree-lined road to the first street on the left, Delaware Avenue. At Delaware, turn left, then immediately right to enter the parking lot at the Battle of Lexington State Historic Site. Pause the tour while you park here, then resume to hear a short introduction about events leading up to the battle.
In 1861, at the onset of the Civil War, Missouri was of particular importance as the westernmost border state, a gateway to the western territories bordered by the Mississippi River and bisected by the Missouri River. Militarily, the situation was grave. That year, the state of Missouri held a constitutional convention to decide the question of secession from the Union. By a vote of 98-1, the representatives chose not to secede. According to the Federal Relations Committee, chaired by Hamilton Rowan Gamble, secession was simply too dangerous. They declared,
"The position of Missouri in relation to the adjacent states which would continue in the Union would necessarily expose her, if she became a member of a new Confederacy, to utter destruction whenever any rupture might take place between the different republics. In a military aspect, secession and connection with a Southern Confederacy is annihilation for Missouri."
However, many, if not most, Missouri residents held Southern sympathies. In May of 1861, after the start of the Civil War, federal troops captured about 750 pro-Southern Missouri State Guard troops at Camp Jackson in St. Louis. After negotiations failed, the pro-Southern governor, Claiborne Jackson, and General Sterling Price, a former governor and the new commander of the State Guard, hoped to capture key points on the Missouri River, thus allowing Missouri to join the Confederacy and setting the stage for the Battle of Lexington. Here at the Visitor Center, you can enjoy a wonderful museum and a film about the battle and tour the Anderson House, which served as a hospital for both sides during the conflict. You can also pick up a map that shows the locations of kiosks at the battlegrounds, which give descriptions of the Battle of Lexington. If you are stopping here to tour the museum, press pause now. Go to the next track when you are ready to resume your tour. If you are continuing on the driving tour, follow these driving instructions to the battlefield entrance.
Pause and resume these directions as needed as you travel to the battle site. Exit the parking lot, turning left onto Delaware Street. At the stop sign, turn left onto John Shea Drive. Drive a short distance and follow the curve right onto Wood Street. Drive approximately 20 yards to the stone gates and gravel entrance on your left. Pull in and park here. Pause the tour until you are parked. Here you can get out of the car and use the map to descriptive kiosks provided by the museum. If taking the walking tour, press pause now. If not, continue listening to a description of the battle.
The Civil War Battle of Lexington was a three-day siege that took place here on September 18th, 19th, and 20th of 1861. Major General Sterling Price led the pro-Southern Missouri State Guard, and Colonel James A. Mulligan from Chicago commanded the Missouri Home Guard units and the 23rd Illinois Infantry, known as the Irish Brigade. Prior to the battle on August 10th, 1861, Federal forces suffered a major defeat at Wilson's Creek, south of Springfield, Missouri. With spirits buoyed by the victory, General Price and his Southern forces moved north to advance upon Lexington. They were joined by irregulars and volunteers eager to help whoop the Yankees. On the eve of the battle, it is estimated that Price had 20,000 troops under his command. Colonel Mulligan's Federal infantry numbered only around 3,500. Some of the fiercest fighting took place on this field. Federal trenches that enclosed 18 acres are still visible. Elaborate defenses included a maze of pits lined with sharpened stakes as an assault barrier, double rows of entrenchments, earthen ramparts more than 10 feet high, and stripped water pipes to lay fuses for a series of mines hidden along the easiest approaches. The Anderson House, on your left and through the trees, is an 1853 Greek Revival house named after its original owner, William Oliver Anderson. It served as the Federal Field Hospital for 120 sick and wounded men, attended to by a surgeon and a chaplain. The neutrality of such a hospital would normally have been respected. However, because of its strategic importance and the general confusion, it was attacked repeatedly by both sides. On the first day of fighting, Wednesday, September 18th, Southern troops captured the Anderson House, claiming it was used by snipers. Colonel Mulligan was furious when word reached him that the enemy had taken the hospital, and he knew that his men in the outer entrenchments were now easy targets for the Southern soldiers who had scampered to the second floor and roof. He ordered an assault, telling his men,
"Teach the damn vagabonds what it means to charge a hospital and abuse wounded men and insult a priest."
80 of Colonel Mulligan's men soon retook the house. Bugler George H. Palmer joined in the assault.
"As we went running toward the Anderson House, the enemy fired from the upper story. 30 of our men fell, dead and wounded. We rushed inside and took possession of the lower floor. I was now filled with dash and enthusiasm. I ran forward and jumped onto the second step of the stairs and turned to the men and said, 'If you will follow me, I will lead you.' And on we went with a yell and a rush."
Palmer later received the Medal of Honor for his bravery. A Southern soldier, W.H. Manser, was inside the house and cut off on the upper level when he and three other soldiers were taken prisoner. As they were being marched downstairs, Manser later recalled,
"I turned and ran back to the upper floor. A Federal soldier came at me with his bayonet fixed, then marched me down the stairs. When near the bottom, where the firing squad was ready, I turned suddenly, struck the Federal soldier's bayonet with my left hand, grabbing him at the same time, and plunged over the dead into the lower hall."
He was eventually led to safety by another Federal soldier. An hour later, Price's men recaptured the Anderson House, marking an end to the five-hour seesaw battle. It remained in Southern hands for the rest of the siege and still shows damage from the intense fighting. The second day of fighting, Thursday, September 19th, was given over to sharpshooters, men who took their work seriously. Federalist Lieutenant Thomas D. McClure, writing in his diary to his wife, told what it was like to be the target of a Southern sharpshooter's deadly intentions.
The rifle and musket balls have been whizzing around our heads so much that we don't notice them as much as we would a bumblebee at home. The first ball that struck the ground very near me, I picked up to show to you. Also the next one, and the next. But I found that if I kept every one that I could feel its hiss as it passed over me, I would be loaded down.
The State Guard consolidated its positions, kept the Federals under heavy artillery fire, and prepared for their final attack. In the oppressive, late summer heat, the Federal troops faced desperate thirst and chronic lack of water. They were cut off from the Missouri River. The wells within their lines had gone dry, and State Guard sharpshooters covered a nearby spring, picking off any man who tried to approach it. Surmising that women might succeed collecting water where the men had failed, Colonel Mulligan sent two of his soldiers' wives with buckets to the spring. General Price's troops held their fire as the women bravely approached. An officer let the women drink their fill. Then he confiscated the buckets. Not a drop of water would be allowed for the beleaguered Federal troops. It was on the third day, Friday, September 20th, that the moniker, the Battle of the Hemp Bales, was born. The weather turned cool with light showers, and the Southern State Guard prepared to make their final assault across open ground. The night before, they took hemp bales from riverfront warehouses, soaked them in the river, and on this morning used them as movable barriers that could not be set aflame by opposing artillery fire. Two or three men would butt the heavy bales forward while others took up fire behind them. Federal troops fired frantically in a futile attempt to keep the bales from advancing. But Price's Southern State Guardsmen inched the hemp bale line forward, slowly and deliberately, advancing toward the enemy. According to Southern veteran Alonzo Shelton,
"By 11 o'clock, we had the most complete line of portable breastworks ever seen."
Of the oncoming hemp bales, a Northern correspondent wrote,
"This immense breastwork commenced moving forward, not in detachments or singly, but in one vast body, unbroken and steady, as though it slid along the ground at its own volition, as impenetrable as a rock. Behind it were hundreds of men pushing and urging with levers, while others held the bales steadily to their places, and others still, whose numbers were almost indefinite, firing between the crevices and over the top at our soldiers. Our men looked at the moving monster in astonishment."
Many years later, in his book, The Rise and Fall of the Confederate Government, former Southern President Jefferson Davis said,
"The expedient use of the bales of hemp was a brilliant conception, not unlike that which made Tarik, the Saracen warrior, immortal, and gave his name to the northern pillar of Hercules."
After several hours, the Southern troops were close enough for a final charge, forcing Colonel Mulligan's men to retreat into the main fortifications around the Masonic College, which you will visit shortly. A grim reminder of the battle was unearthed in 1932 when excavations at the Masonic College site found the remains of five bodies covered by a blanket. These unknown Federal soldiers were reinterred here on these grounds. Their final resting place is near the monument to the Federal soldiers who fought in the battle. The tour will now continue on to the Russell, Majors, and Waddell Monument, and then to the Masonic College site where the Battle of Lexington came to an end.
Exit the battlefield entrance and continue on Wood Street as it curves south by the main entrance to the Lafayette Regional Health Center. Immediately park on the right, across from the Health Center entrance.
On your left, at the edge of the Health Center parking lot, is a brick and iron monument to the Russell, Majors, and Waddell Freighting Company. By the 1850s, Russell, Majors, and Waddell employed more than 4,000 men, 3,500 wagons, and some 40,000 oxen throughout the region. William Russell, Alexander Majors, and William Waddell were also the founders of the famous Pony Express. It ran from St. Joseph, Missouri, across the Great Plains, over the Rocky Mountains and the Sierra Nevada to Sacramento, California. Back in 1860, riding for the Pony Express was difficult work. Riders had to be tough and lightweight. There is a famous advertisement that reportedly read,
"Wanted, young, skinny, wiry fellas, not over 18. Must be expert riders, willing to risk death daily. Orphans preferred."
Alexander Majors was a deeply religious man and resolved, by the help of God, to overcome all difficulties. He presented each new rider with a Bible and required them to speak this oath.
"I do hereby swear before the great and living God that during my engagement, and while I am an employee of Russell, Majors, and Waddell, I will under no circumstances use profane language, that I will drink no intoxicating liquors, and that I will not quarrel or fight with any other employee of the firm, and that in every respect I will conduct myself honestly, be faithful to my duties, and so direct all my acts as to win the confidence of my employers, so help me God."
The Pony Express initially involved 120 riders, 184 stations, 400 horses, and several hundred personnel. It ceased operations after only 6 months, when the completion of the Transcontinental Telegraph made it obsolete. The tour now continues to the Masonic College site for the conclusion of the Battle of Lexington.
As you travel to the Masonic College site, pause and resume these directions as needed. Now, proceed forward or south along the back of the hospital towards State Street, where you will turn left. Turn left onto State Street and go up the hill, past the Health Center entrance on your left. Go slowly here and prepare to turn left at the next intersection, 16th Street. At the 16th Street intersection, turn left into the small parking lot at the Masonic College site. Park here. If you would like to walk the grounds, press pause and advance to the next track when you return. If not, listen now to a brief history of the Masonic College site and the conclusion of the Battle of Lexington.
The Park Pavilion is a quarter-size replica of the original Masonic College building, which was the first Masonic college in the world, and has a cannon from the USS Constitution, Old Ironsides, famed for its victories in the War of 1812. Following the Civil War, Central College, a Methodist female school, took over the Masonic College site. To the right, or the east of the park entrance at 1618 State Street, stands a red Beaux Art brick house, which was the college president's home. The main college building was destroyed by fire, and the institution merged in 1924 with another Methodist college in Fayette, Missouri. During the Battle of Lexington, the Masonic College building was used as the federal headquarters. The basement was used to produce ammunition. A marker to the right of the building indicates where Colonel Mulligan maintained his tent, under which was buried $900,000 confiscated from a downtown bank. After the battle, General Price returned the money, with a few thousand missing, and Governor Jackson withdrew $37,000 he said the state legislature had approved for state defense. On the third and final day of fighting, September 20th, 1861, Federal Colonel James Mulligan and his troops took refuge in the Masonic College building after hastily fortifying the surrounding area with baling wire and crude landmines. Southern State Guard batteries surrounded the area and kept up a steady barrage of artillery fire. Federal troops waited for an incoming barrage, noted the location of the impact, then picked up the spent projectiles and fired them back. Charles Lantheum, a teenage private stationed in the headquarters, was told to shovel hotshot as it exploded through the roof.
"I watched for the flash of the cannon, then took shelter until the ball struck. and then shovel them from the building.
The young man remained at his post throughout the battle. At 1 p.m., a fierce attack by the Southern State Guard was launched. Major F.W. Becker and his pro-federal German troops, who had been a main target of the hemp bale offensive, fled into the main fortifications around the Masonic College building. Seeing that Colonel Mulligan and all his officers were wounded, Major Becker raised a white flag. Mulligan's heart sank. Though his men continued to fight valiantly, they were near their limits, and this white flag did more to break their will than 1,000 enemy cannon. Mulligan sent a messenger to ask on what terms General Price might accept a surrender. Price made it clear. Surrender was
unconditional, by God, and 5 minutes to decide in.
Though out of water, low on ammunition, and greatly outnumbered, Colonel Mulligan ordered his men to stay their ground.
I ordered them to return to their lines and use their bayonets or perish. They grasped their weapons the fiercer and turned calmly about and stood firmly at their posts. And there they stood without a murmur, praying as they never prayed before that the rebels would show themselves. But one of my officers remarked that this was butchery. The conviction became general, and I called my captains to a council of war. They voted to surrender.
By 2 p.m., the federal soldiers walked out of the fortification and laid down their arms. The Battle of Lexington was over. At the surrender ceremony, General Price addressed the federal troops, telling them,
"You were the hardest troops to capture I have ever seen."
The spoils of battle went to the victors. Besides the prisoners and the 7 pieces of artillery, General Price took possession of over 3,000 stands of infantry arms, a large number of sabers, plus an ample quantity of ammunition. On the political front, the victory bolstered the spirit and determination of those favoring secession. Price announced that he would release the prisoners on their promise not to take up arms against Missouri or the Confederacy. All federal troops were paroled except Mulligan, who believed the state of Missouri had no right to make him break his oath of allegiance to the federal government. He was to be sent south as a prisoner. Mrs. Mulligan, seeing her husband's depressed state, asked to accompany him and nurse him back to health. General Price reluctantly agreed on the condition that their 1-year-old daughter remain behind. A Lexington woman took pity on Mrs. Mulligan and agreed to keep the child as long as necessary. Colonel Mulligan was later paroled, but ultimately killed in 1864 at the Second Battle of Kernston in Virginia. Success was short-lived for General Price. Without adequate support and following a demand by President Lincoln that Lexington be retaken, Price retreated south less than 3 weeks later. Federal forces occupied Lexington for the remainder of the war. About 40 Missouri State Guardsmen and 140 federal troops were killed in the Battle of Lexington, with 300 more from both sides seriously wounded. After the Battle of Lexington, a local man stole Colonel Mulligan's sword and hid it in his barn. When his wife found out, she made him send it back to Mulligan's widow in Chicago. Years later, Mulligan's daughter sent the sword back to Lexington in appreciation for the kindness shown to her and her mother during and after the battle. Colonel Mulligan's battlefield sword is now featured prominently in the Lexington Historical Museum. This concludes the Battle of Lexington portion of the tour. We will now continue on to Wentworth Military Academy. Please follow these directions.
As you travel to Wentworth, pause and resume these directions as needed. Exit the parking lot carefully and continue as before, heading east on State Street toward the stop sign at 17th Street. At 17th Street, Turn right, continuing south along the white wall bordering the Wentworth campus. Continue to your first left, Washington Avenue. Turn left onto Washington Avenue. Park on the street near the Wentworth parking lot, halfway up the block and on your right. Pause the tour and advance to the next track when you are parked.
Wentworth Military Academy and College was originally founded in 1880 as Hobson's Select School for Boys. A year later, the school became Wentworth Male Academy when the school's benefactor, Stephen G. Wentworth, purchased it and renamed it in memory of his recently deceased son. The evolution to a military school was prompted by a student named Ephraim King, who in the early 1880s organized his fellow students and began conducting drills and maneuvers as an extracurricular activity, which they performed with broomsticks. The school's leaders saw good outcomes in these efforts, such as improved discipline and fitness, and by the end of the decade, a military regiment was formalized into the overall boarding program. The first president of Wentworth was Colonel Sanford Sellers, who served for over 50 years. In a 1928 letter to parents considering a Wentworth education for their sons, President Sellers wrote,
"All parents know that a boy's character is forming while he is in high school and college. He is changing from boyhood to manhood. Wise parents should periodically ask themselves, is our son doing as well as he should in his present school? Is he learning to take on responsibilities? Is he becoming robust and manly? Are his associates of the best? Do we thoroughly understand his problems and needs? Here at Wentworth, we have been endeavoring to answer such queries for half a century."
President Sellers believed Wentworth's purpose was to prepare its graduates for college and professional life. That mission remains unchanged, and since 1993, now applies to young women as well. Currently, Wentworth has more than 200 boarding students and a total enrollment of more than 1,000, including day and part-time students. Its many illustrious graduates include film director Robert Altman, Wild Kingdom host Marlon Perkins, Major League Baseball player Beals Becker, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Paul Henderson, Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark A. Welsh, and Congressman Ike Skelton, who served in the United States Congress for 34 years and was a beloved and lifelong Lexington resident. Wentworth's campus is comprised of historic buildings dating from the late 1880s to more modern ones built during the 20th century and as late as 2003. Plans are continually in the works for additional expansion to meet the students' and faculty's needs. Behind you and on the left is the outdoor stadium called Alumni Field. In 1923, the Wentworth Alumni Association began discussing plans for the construction of a new football field. However, nothing was done until 1926, when Captain Lester Wyckoff was appointed director of a campaign to raise $30,000 from the alumni. That same year, November 17th was declared a work day, and alumni joined hands with cadets and faculty in breaking ground for the new athletic field. On that first day, the old blue barracks and the outdoor swimming pool were demolished. About 13,000 yards of earth were later removed, and by November 1st, 1927, the field was complete and ready for use with a seating capacity of 5,000. On November 11th, 1927, the first game was played on the new alumni field against Principia Academy of St. Louis. The tall brick building to your left is Hickman Hall, also known as the West Barracks. It was constructed in 1907 to house the growing number of cadets at a cost of $21,292.74. In 1926, the barracks was dedicated in honor of Colonel Edwin A. Hickman, who served as Wentworth's commandant from 1894 to 1898. Ahead of you on the right, at the southeast corner of Washington Avenue and 18th Street, is the Wallace House, also called the Butler House. Built in the 1850s by one of the earliest settlers of the area, it was set on fire during the Battle of Lexington because, according to Federal officer Major Van Horn,
it made a shelter for sharpshooters. The consultation of our commanding officers was held and a decision made to burn it. A detail was ordered to the work. I saw them go to their errand and return after the fire had been started.
The house was later rebuilt in the new Italianate style.
Now, you may park in the Wentworth parking lot to your right and walk this portion of the tour. If continuing driving toward 18th Street, be aware that the gates on Washington are sometimes closed to traffic. If walking, park on the street or in the lot. Walk to 18th Street, cross 18th Street, and walk toward the dragon statue. Then resume the tour when you arrive at the statue. If driving, slowly cross 18th Street and park across from the white pillared building on your left.
On the north side of Washington Avenue is the Administration Building, originally a much smaller structure known as the Mitchell House. In 1883, it was donated along with roughly 9 acres by Stephen Wentworth to provide additional space for boarding students. In 1938, the original porch was replaced by the two-story columns. In addition to housing cadets, administration, and the mess hall, a portion of the original Mitchell House was the residence of the superintendents and their families from 1883 until 1952. The dragon sculpture in front of the administration building is the Wentworth mascot. In 1924, the Wentworth athletic teams became known as the Red Dragons. In an article published in the 1924 edition of the school's newspaper, The Trumpeter, Coach James Hill explained that Wentworth was searching for something that would exemplify a fighting spirit. According to the coach, the Red Dragons filled the bill because
the mythical dragon symbolizes aggressiveness and fight. The name Red was attached because of the color of the Wentworth Fighting Togs. Then we wanted something that had a connection to the school. At the top of the Wentworth coat of arms, a dragon is engraved. The dragon is thus a part of the official seal. Lastly, we wanted something that could be easily symbolized or pictured. The name is appropriate for this reason.
If walking, continue east on the sidewalk to Grundyke Hall. If driving, pull ahead slowly toward the entrance to the next building on your left.
In the middle of the block, on the north side, is Grundyke Hall. Built in 1914 at a cost of $15,000 and expanded in 1920 to add space for athletics, a military department, and a swimming pool. In later years, when a new field house was constructed, it became the Student Union Building. During the 1990s, the old gymnasium was named Grundyke Hall in honor of John Grundyke, a former cadet battle group commander and chairman of the Board of Trustees. In addition to classrooms, offices, and conference rooms, Grundyke Hall houses the Wentworth Hall of Honor, which displays photos and stories of alumni who have achieved Silver Stars, become flag officers, and received the Congressional Medal of Honor. Throughout the Wentworth campus are monuments to those who served in wars and conflicts around the globe. To the left of the Grundyke Hall entrance is a small stone monument surrounded by a circular path It is dedicated to a Missouri State Guard battery that was located here during the Battle of Lexington. A little further east, to the right of the Grand Ike Hall entrance, stands the most beloved of the Wentworth memorials, the Spirit of the American Doughboy. It was chosen by the alumni of 1921 to honor over 500 of Wentworth's own who served in World War I, and pays particular tribute to the 16 who gave their lives. Originally dedicated in 1923, it was rededicated as part of Wentworth's 125th anniversary celebration in 2004. A time capsule buried beneath is thought to contain a school newspaper, a roster of cadets, textbooks, and a bottle of Jim Beam. Looking further east, surrounding the quad, you can see Sanford Sellers Hall, the Wentworth Chapel, Tillotson Barracks, and the Wyckoff Sellers Scholastic Building. Beyond these buildings, near the center of the Great Lawn, stands the Vietnam War Memorial, symbolized by a UH-1 helicopter, the workhorse of the U.S. forces during the war. The sacrifices of the first American killed in Vietnam, Major Dale R. Buis, and Medal of Honor recipient Major William E. Adams are remembered here with special pride. A little further on, past the Vietnam Memorial, you can see the President's Residence, an 1830s Greek Revival house. Wentworth acquired this house in 1917. It was built by a partner in Russell, Majors, and Waddell, the Lexington company that started the Pony Express. The house was part of a farm where they raised hemp to make rope and made wagons for the Santa Fe and Oregon trails. Behind the house was a chicken coop, a smokehouse, and a row of three frame rooms for the slaves. There was also a rope walk, where they twisted the long strands of hemp into rope as they walked.
If walking, cross Washington Avenue at 19th Street. If driving, pull ahead and park near the corner of 19th Street.
On the southwest corner of 19th and Washington is the Norma Mehring Alumni Hall, a Romanesque brick home with a tower and decorative chimney. It is named after Norma Mehring, who coached swimming and taught dancing at Wentworth for over 40 years. When the first six female college students arrived at Wentworth in 1993, they stayed in this house. The introduction of female cadets had both supporters and detractors, but according to Mrs. Mehring, the young women made it clear from the beginning that they would fit right in.
They were just absolutely great. They said, you know, the news media would be following them around a lot, and they'd be watched a lot. Well, you wouldn't have known it, because they were just typical young ladies that were going to college. And the cadets accepted them to no end. I got amused, but I could have had a phone on the end of my desk and answered 24 hours a day. It seems like I felt like putting a sign out in front, like in the Charlie Brown things, where Lucy has this sign that says, "The doctor is in, 5 cents, please." Well, the first, you know, I'd pick up the phone and they'd say, "What are you guys doing? You think you're going broke down there? Is that the reason the board said that you could have girls? You should have girls? We don't understand this." Next time the phone would ring, I'd pick it up and they'd say, "Well, it's about time you had girls. I tell you, it's a good thing you didn't have when I came, because I'd never gotten any studying done." After that first year, there wasn't a question about it from anybody, because these young ladies just stepped in and academically, athletically, marching, everything else, they were absolutely just great.
The next year, high school girls were allowed to enroll at Wentworth, and due to the high number, they were moved to different housing. This former home now houses the Wentworth Alumni Department. The music you've heard during this part of your tour has been performed by the 1977 Wentworth Band under the direction of Captain Roger A. Kendall. Here, they perform the Wentworth theme. Thank you. This concludes the tour of the Battle of Lexington State Historic Site and Wentworth Military Academy. We hope you have enjoyed the experience and will take tours of the other historic districts of legendary Lexington.
If walking, return to your car in the parking lot on 18th Street. To head back downtown, take 18th Street South to Main and turn right. If driving, turn right or south onto 19th Street. Go one block to Main. Turn right onto Main to return to downtown.
Legends of Lexington Audio Tours is a production of the Lexington Community Arts Pilot Project, a three-way collaboration between the University of Missouri Extension, the University of Missouri, and the community of Lexington, Missouri, designed to promote community and economic development through the arts. This project is dedicated in loving memory to Roger Slusher. Roger was a lifelong Lexington resident and considered Lexington's historian. He taught history at Wentworth Military Academy and directed the Lexington Historical Museum and the Santa Fe Trail Association. With his wife, Sandra, Roger contributed invaluable resources and guidance to this project. Legends of Lexington was produced and directed by Houston Walkinshaw. Sound engineering by William J. Lackey, Assistant Teaching Professor of Composition and Managing Director of the Mizzou New Music Initiative. Scripting by Dan Cambridge and Houston Walkinshaw. And narration and voices by the citizens and friends of Lexington. Funding for this project was provided by premier sponsors Bill and Julie LaHue, Steve and Wilma Sellers, and the Lexington Tourism Commission, as well as more than 30 other community sponsors. Additional funding was provided by the Sinkfield Charitable Foundation and the MU School of Music, with special thanks to Robert Shea, by Lafayette County Live Healthy, Live Well, Union Pacific Foundation, and the Richard S. Brownlee Fund of the State Historical Society of Missouri. Our thanks to the many other volunteers and supporters from the community of Lexington and beyond for their priceless contributions to this project.